Welcome to a special edition of the Daytime Confidential podcast. On today's show, we have an exclusive interview with Thom Mersina, the Emmy-nominated writer and author responsible for General Hospital's Ice Princess storyline and Luke and Laura's wedding, what it was like to work with Elizabeth Taylor, and how he married off Beau and Hope on Days of Our Lives and created the character of John Black. We also discuss what it was like to work with Brad Pitt and what he's been up to since leaving Daytime, and would he ever come back? We guarantee that you'll enjoy this episode, so stay tuned.
Hello,
is this Thom Mersina?
Yes, it is.
This is Luke calling from the Daytime Confidential podcast. How are you?
Hi, good. How are you?
Pretty good. I'm looking forward to this visit this evening. I have Belinda, one of our regular contributors, on the podcast with me because she knows General Hospital history much more than I do. I've only been watching for about 10 years. So
she probably knows it better than I do. Well,
don't be intimidated. I won't if you're not.
There is that possibility that she may, because she's currently writing some history pieces for the website. So it's always interesting to get perspectives. But then it's also a rare opportunity to be able to speak with someone who's been in the industry or was in the industry for as long as you were. And
I know, in the trenches, in the salt mines for all those years.
Well, but at the same time, you were involved in it during the period of time, because I was reading your bio, and you were involved in it during its heyday.
It was the heyday. In fact, writing the Luke and Laura Ice Princess story was kind of like writing pop history. It wasn't like writing a television show at all.
Well, and I was going to ask...
So you felt that at the time? Could you feel that at the time?
We really felt it, because the ratings were so enormous. The whole country was talking about it. You'd often see articles in the newspapers about General Hospital, how it's grabbing all these people, and they're scheduling classes around it, and businesses are closing for Luke and Laura's wedding. But it was really Luke and Laura's wedding that made us realize we had touched a nerve in the country that was so much bigger than just a TV show, because, you know, we were on the cover of Newsweek and People magazine, and it was an amazing, heady time, and none of us will ever forget it.
For those of the listeners who have not visited your website, it's thommersina.com, and on there you have a bio about how you got involved in the Ice Princess storyline, in Luke and Laura, in General Hospital. Tell the listeners what that was like, how that all came about, and some of your experiences there.
It was a real fluke. I didn't know daytime TV at all. I was a novelist, and I had only seen Dark Shadows a couple times when I was in college.
My favorite.
Right. And it was the last live show, and you'd see Grayson Hall pulling doorknobs off of, off the set was falling apart. And I used to watch it.
Booms falling on them.
A whole flat came over, a whole wall came over once. Anyway, that's all I had seen, and I paid no attention. And I had a big hardcover novel that sold very well all over the world, got bought for the movies, blah, blah, blah. It was called The Great Los Angeles Blizzard, about a snowstorm that destroys L.A. where it never snows. And the option that Irwin Allen, who made, all the disaster films way back
then, Towering Inferno.
Exactly. It was on the end. My Blizzard story was on the end of the cusp of those. Plus, it was too expensive. Today, digital effects can do it. But back then, they would have had to dump ivory snow all over Hollywood Boulevard. The movie was too expensive, so they didn't do it. Okay, so the rights had reverted to me. And I got a call from Jackie Smith, who ran ABC Daytime, who I did not remember. She had met me years before when I was working on a project at Warner Brothers. And she said, I want you to meet with Gloria Monty. I said, who's Gloria Monty? She said, she's producer of General Hospital. I said, what's General Hospital?
Oh, man.
I met this woman, and I brought a copy of my book along to her. And at lunch, she told me a very odd story. She said, there is a writer's strike coming, and I know it's going to happen. This is back in 1980. And she said, the woman who's writing the show, started a story called The Ice Princess, and she will not tell me what it is.
Oh, my goodness.
And she had a few great words for her head writer at that time, then, which I won't repeat. And I should have learned. That's how head writers get treated whenever the ratings start to fall. But in any case, she said to me, she said, I can hire you to do a story, a long-term story, and it's legal. She said, we can air it through the strike. Anything we pay for before, any story consulting that we do, it's legal. It's not going to hurt you with the Writers Guild. And I said, okay, fine. And I said, so, what is The Ice Princess? She said, I have no idea. And we looked at my book sitting there, and she said, Snow. And I said, yeah, in Port Charles, you know, because she was talking about Port Charles. I went home. And I did that. I wrote, it was almost like about a 700-page document. It was detail of the entire Ice Princess story leading toward when Luke and Laura would get married at the end of it. And that's what aired. And when that whole strike thing was over, I was hired to come to the show and indeed, you know, wrote The Wedding of Luke and Laura, which I still make money off of.
Well, isn't that great?
Well, and yeah, so did you write, when you were writing that a huge document, did you write all of the dialogue or was it just
outlines? It's what a head writer does. It was the long story. Then it was broken down into weeks and then it was broken down into days. And almost in the outlines, I can't say it was scene by scene, but it was pretty close because Gloria really knew what was going on, and she loved the idea of it, the Luke and Laura, you know, stopping the snow on Port Charles, and that became pop history.
Well, so I'll bet you if you still had that thing, you could auction that thing off or send it to the Smithsonian, one of the two. I mean, just think about it. If you actually had the whole Ice Princess storyline written out, it could probably end up in the Smithsonian.
You're probably right.
It should, because it really defined our time. It defined our time.
Yeah. It did. It truly did. You know, it's funny. I've had that thought before that, you know, who knew eBay and all those things were coming? If I had stockpiled scripts and outlines, I could be a very rich man today.
All those
things to the fans.
Obviously, you started the Ice Princess storyline. You outlined it for them. They wrote it. I was talking with a friend the other day about this interview, and they said, oh, one of my favorite scenes from the Luke and Laura days was when they either get locked or they are in the department store at night, and they end
at
up
Wyndham's.
Having – I don't remember the store or the name. What did you say?
Yeah,
Wyndham's?
Yeah.
It was
I can't
Wyndham's
remember the
department
name.
Store.
Yeah, something like that.
Wyndham's,
And
they said,
I remember how romantic that ended up being. It was a wonderful fantasy. Yeah.
So they wanted me to ask you if you were in part responsible for helping to write that, because that was one of their all-time favorite moments.
I was involved already then, yes.
Now, on your bio, you said that after the strike ended, you were actually brought on as a full-time writer.
Yeah, right.
Was it co-head writer?
Well, yeah, it was. There was a friend of Gloria's named Bob Shaw, and he had been around for a long time and done a lot of things, and he basically sat there and flew paper airplanes around the writer's office. And I really served as a head writer, but one of the reasons that I didn't have that entire title and wasn't the only one was that Gloria was worried about me having written all of that through, you know, that they aired all my story, that people at the Writers Guild would be angry or that I would suffer some repercussions at the time about, you know, having been a union writer, but even though it was very legal, and we talked to the Writers Guild about this, my agent did, and she just wanted to protect me. But yes, then I was co-head writer with Leah Lehman, and the two of us did the next 2 years of stuff, and then I went on to Days of Our Lives.
Well, now, on your bio, you mentioned how it all came about that Elizabeth Taylor ended up being Helena Cassidyne, that you created Helena for her. Well,
yes.
Constant Towers as Helena is the only Helena that I've ever known, and the Cassidyne family is like literally my favorite family on General Hospital. So what was it like?
He insists on calling the Cassidynes a core family. We
yes,
argue about that all the
I maintain
time.
They're a core family. She doesn't agree with me.
I'm like, oh no.
So what was it like to A, introduce the Cassidyne family, be able to work with Elizabeth Taylor on it, and what was that all like leading up to the wedding and everything that took place there?
Well, the crazy story is this. There was a story meeting that we were having, and it was indeed about the wedding of Luke and Laura. It looked very clear to everybody that we were going to marry them, finally, which is people have been, you know, dying for 2 years.
Yeah, we were going insane.
Right. And I said, wait a minute, they get boring when they're married. Let's drag this out another year or at least 6 months. And so we were literally having a meeting to discuss that point, whether we would lose the fans or if, you know, we would do something with Scotty and we'd make it last a little longer before we actually married them. Well, there was a red phone in the conference room where we had the meeting with it was off Gloria's office, and that red phone was like the phone to the Pope or the phone to the Pentagon, you know, and it never rang during a story meeting. It was the network in New York, and it never rang during a story meeting. They shut it off. Well, the phone rang, and we all sat there looking at it like, what the hell is going on? And Gloria muttered something like, maybe the building is burned down in New York City and they're calling to tell us. So she picks up the phone, and this little itty-bitty voice was screaming and yelling, and she couldn't get in a word edgewise. And if you knew Gloria Monty, she could always get in a word edgewise. So she said to this person, she said, talk to the guy who's responsible. And she handed me the phone. And I simply said hello, and I hear this voice say, you don't know how many damn movie sets I shut down to watch Luke and Laura, and you're not going to give me a wedding? And I looked at Gloria, and I said, it's like a bad Elizabeth Taylor impersonation somebody's doing, and she said, I think it is. and indeed, it was. She had called the network because she heard that we may not marry them. And she was so pissed off that she was screaming and yelling. And I didn't know what the hell to say to this woman. I simply said, well, listen, if we give a wedding, will you come? And she giggled and she said, oh, I'd like that. The next day, they made a deal. And Gloria said to me, what the hell are we going to do with her? And I said, we're going to make her Helena Cassidyne, the widow in black. And that's how it happened.
I'm just getting shivers listening to that.
We married
Luke and Laura because of Elizabeth Taylor. I mean, we married them when we did because of her. She was the impetus. We were stuck having to do it. But, of course, it brought us the greatest ratings of all time with her appearance helped.
I read that you are the one responsible for Scotty Baldwin catching the bouquet.
Yeah, you know, that was my favorite moment. But we did the wedding, and oh, I got another great Liz story. I'll tell you in a second. But yeah, we were ready up to taping the wedding, and I kept saying, "Wait a minute. There's something missing here. There's some twist at the end of the whole damn thing." And I couldn't come. And in the middle of the night, it came to me, and I called Gloria. And in the middle of the night, woke her up. I said, "Scotty catches the bouquet," and she said, "Oh my God!" You know.
Well, I have to tell you.
Yes.
Yeah, as your audience, as the person that was sitting out here glued to that every day, that was the moment. I mean, I remember like four people in my living room jumping to their feet and just gasping. It was very theatrical at our house when Scotty caught that bouquet.
Yeah, it was great. I got to tell you, the wonderful Liz story is that, and she was marvelous to work with. She had never really done TV, and she had a whole new respect for television 2 weeks after she, you know, finished her taping and all. And it was, I've got stories that go on for days, and it's going to go in my memoirs one day. But the funny story is they were taping an insert shot, and it was of her at the wedding, the famous moment when she puts the curse on Laura. She says, "A curse on you, Laura, and Luke, a curse on you forever, or your children, or whatever," which they're still playing till today. In any case, she absolutely was the most beautiful thing you had ever seen. She was in the widow's weeds and the mink, and she had the big Taylor Burton diamond on, and the Brinks guards were standing on each side of the doors of the studio. I mean, it was an amazing moment, and she did the lines just as I wrote them. And I worked with her when I did the scenes. I mean, I wrote all the Helena scenes myself. We didn't give them to a script writer. And I worked with her, and it was like kowtowing to this great, famous woman. But she was absolutely sensational, and she was so thrilled. She loved doing this because she was such a fan. In any case, she does the scene, and she says the line very straight, and I think it's wonderful, and somebody says cut, and the director didn't like it, and Gloria wasn't sure, and the network, they all put their 2 cents in, and, you know, time is money in television, and it was going on for a good half hour, and she's under the hot lights, and the mink, and the whatever, and they're schmitzing her, and powdering her, and she's sweating, and finally, everybody's got a new idea. It should be bigger, there should be thunder, she should pull something out of her purse, she should... all these ridiculous ideas, and she stomped her foot, and everybody turned to her, and she said, "I have an idea," and everybody hushed and looked at her, and she said, "Why don't I just lift my leg and piss on him?"
Did not see that one coming. Did not see that one coming.
It put everybody in their place. It made them realize how ridiculous they were, and we shot the scene again, just as she did it the first time. Simple, clear, and it was a done deal. But it was the funniest moment I have ever seen in my entire career.
That is so amazing. Yeah. Now, on your bio on your website, you mentioned some of the little tidbits about what took place, and we would encourage our listeners to go there. I mean, you mentioned how Tony and Jeannie loathed each other, and how Tristan would have to like deliver the lines, and how you mentioned Demi Moore and Rick Springfield. In addition to those, if they want to check those out on your website, do you have any other little behind the scenes tidbits that you can share with the listeners?
Oh God, I remember the day that Jesse Brewer, you know, the nurse Emily McLaughlin, who was on forever.
Well, she was the head nurse.
Okay.
Who lived at the front, at the desk there? You know, she was always. I mean, for years we did nothing with her except keep her at the desk, and she kind of said hello to anybody who walked through. And she was a lovely gal, and I had a lot of fun with her. But she had this blue sweater, and the blue sweater. Somebody said, I think it was Denise Alexander said, "I think that sweater is her character." And one day, somebody took that blue sweater and hid it. And indeed, it was the character. She was hysterical. She couldn't go on. She couldn't do the scene, even though she had nothing to do with it. And Gloria was standing there going, "I want that sweater returned." It was just a ludicrous moment that made us all laugh. But another kind of funny inside story about Emily was that very early one morning, and I'm a late night guy, I'm a vampire, and I don't do well early in the morning, but I'd have to go for certain meetings early. Anyway, I was there very early one day, and the actors were kind of waking up and running their lines, and Emily had a mug of tea, and everybody else was drinking coffee. There was a tea bag hanging from it, and I grabbed the coffee pot, and I was pouring Stuart Damon and somebody else coffee. And I said, oh, Emily, do you want... And I said, oh, no, you've got tea. And I forget who it was, but a woman said to me, you really think that's tea? And I said, well, there's a tea bag hanging from the... She said, go look at it. Well, Emily walked away, and I went over and looked at the mug. The little label, like Lipton, was tied to the handle. And inside of it was bourbon.
Oh, my goodness.
It was just great.
That's
fun.
Classic. That's
classic. Yeah.
You mentioned that you're responsible for writing Helena, who is one of my favorite all-time characters. And that brought me to something that I'm dying to ask you. When new writers come on our shows, the fans always lament that they backburner or kill off some of our established characters. And we've always heard this, like, urban legend that has something to do with the fact that old writers get some kind of residual or compensation for characters that they've created.
No.
Is there any truth to that?
No, none. Oh. None at all. You don't own anything. Yeah, you don't own anything you do on television, unless you're David Letterman and he owns his own show. All of that is owned by ABC. Any character you create, any story you create is theirs. Even though I stole the Ice Princess story from my own novel, it became their story, you know, set in Port Charles. But no, characters, everybody writes all the characters. You know, the outline writers will be writing all the characters, and let's say there are co-head writers, and one of them comes up with a new character, and that character becomes very big. That writer does not have any kind of ownership with that character.
The reason
why that happens is that people come in, and there's two things they bring to the table. They bring their own ideas and their own kind of long-term kind of story vision. And sometimes it just doesn't include some of the characters that have been on the show or that the fans love. And other times, too, I think that the new head writers, sometimes don't pay enough attention. And they get caught up in, let's do this, let's do that, and they kind of sweep away some of the characters, stories, beloved people. You see that all the time with details. Yeah, you see that. It's like the old story was Bob Shaw told me this story once that he was doing, I think, Search for Tomorrow, and I forget who was doyen of that show, one of the great names in daytime, the woman who was, and he got onto the show, and he sat down in a story meeting that she was present at because she was the main character, and he said, I got this great story, you're going to have a hysterectomy. And this was many years ago when that was kind of like new kind of stuff, you know, new blazing new ground. And he said, you're going to have a hysterectomy, and it's going to be the emotional story, the physical story, and your daughter, and da da ba ba ba. And at the end of it, she politely listened to the whole thing, and she turned to him, and she said, a hysterectomy, she said, it will be my third.
Oh, no.
You can only have one. And they had done it twice already. So that just illustrates how head writers come in with their own stories, not having paid attention to the history of the character.
And they really don't. There's no effort made to know what they're picking up from or
There absolutely should be. You have got to do your damn homework.
Yeah.
You've got to study the show. You've got to learn those characters. You've got to learn the history. The thing that I always did when I started a new show is I talked to the fans. I would call my cousin Jody, you know, and say,
exactly.
Hey, Jody, look, I'm going to do another world, and I know you watch it. Now tell me. I want to know, you know, let me know. I want to know everything that you can tell me about Linda Dano's character, you know, that kind of thing. It's important.
We don't feel like they're doing that anymore.
Well, with the exception, though,
yeah.
Ron Carlovati, who just took over for One Life to Live last year, has done an amazing job in the critical acclaim. Unfortunately, the ratings haven't quite followed it, but, I mean, the stuff that's happening on One Life to Live is the best it's been in years.
I've always thought One Life is a good show. I always wanted to do that show, and I came close to doing it, but there was a skirmish with another writer who it was a miserable story, and I never did it. But I went on to something else instead. But I had missed doing that. I always wanted to.
I would like to know if you were as surprised as the viewers were that science fiction worked on daytime TV when you did the Ice Princess.
Yeah, we were. When I wrote Blizzard, I never thought of it as science fiction. I simply thought of it as weather that goes crazy. And this is long before global warming. You know, I rewrote the book, and it's called Deep Freeze, and it came out 2 years ago, and it's done very well as a paperback with the same snowstorm in Los Angeles. But I didn't really, really think of it being science fiction. But then, of course, when we started to translate the story to Port Charles, and we dreamed up this crazy island and weather machine kind of thing, it became a lot more science fiction-like. And Gloria, this was the genius of Gloria Monty. There's a balance in everyone's life, and there's a lot of things about that woman that we could list that balances out her genius. But her genius was that she could take risks. And she believed in them. She said, "We're going to do something different." I mean, look what she did with the rape. No one had, I mean, whoever would have the guts to have a guy rape a girl and then turn it around? God, that was hard for us to do. And create the love couple of all time, you know? Gloria was great that way. She really, she had a sense that this was going to work, and boy, was she right.
Well, expand on that a little bit more, because Laura's rape is almost as iconic as the wedding. Yeah. And you said you had difficulty turning it around. What was it like to go through that, and what were some of the things that you had to deal with back then that you may not have had to deal with today if you were writing that exact same story?
I've got a feeling that it might be as difficult today, or maybe even harder. I don't think it was any easier then. I think rape is even seen as uglier today. I don't know. That's just my own sense of the world and morality, and something that includes violence and that kind of unwarranted force. Even though, in the end we really made it that Laura really wanted him and da 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 da, it was a very, very tough thing to do.
Did you have any pushback on the network?
The network, when everybody started to realize that these two had a magic together, a chemistry, it was like, okay, what do we do to keep them together? And
that's what I was going to ask, is if was it after the rape that it was discovered that you just could not let this volatility they had go?
Exactly. And it so often happens like that. You hire somebody to come on for a week or two as a day player, and, he's going to be the bad guy who does something to somebody, and then, that's the end of them. But here was a guy who had a magic, and that magic was not only his own, it was a magic that he created with Jeannie. And when Gloria started to see it, she said, "Wait a minute, we're not going to get rid of him. We're not going to keep him bad. We're going to make this work somehow." And again, that's part of her genius, to take that risk.
It really was being able to see lightning striking, because you could tell from the fans' point of view at first that somebody didn't know how good those two were together.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. No one had a clue. No. He was an actor that Gloria had worked with before. She liked him and thought, let's give him he needs some work.
It was sort of a favor that turned into superstar.
Well, she knew he'd be good for the role they had created, and I wasn't there yet. That I came in after the rape. So, whatever she was doing with Pat Smith, whatever she did was create this guy who was, going to be the bad guy who was, oh, I forgot. He was like the right-hand man for the the bad
Frank
guy.
Smith.
Frank.
Yeah, he was running the disco, laundering money for
Frank Smith. And I think that, you know, it was just that simple. Gloria said, oh, there's a great actor. He'll pull this off, and we'll have him do it. And they hired him, and it became a very different thing.
Well, I believe it was, what, a year? No, it's actually 2 years almost now ago now. Luke and Laura celebrated their 25th anniversary. There was a lot of media press about it. As someone who was the person who wrote it, did you watch that when that took place? And if so, how did you feel about seeing the characters 25 years later?
It was, I watched it later because I think I was out of the country. I'm trying to remember what I travel constantly. I'm like a junkie. But I had somebody tape that week there, and I felt proud. I gotta say, I felt proud, and I got chills every once in a while. And I'm gonna tell you, after doing that for 30 years, you really don't think you can be moved by it. You know, you kind of look back and say, oh, you know, it was great, it was wonderful, it's what I did, and we had a lot of fun, and da 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 da. And you really don't think it's gonna touch you today, but it really did. And I've got a feeling that if I saw chunks of other shows I did, I wouldn't have quite the same, I don't know, burst of enthusiasm and pride that I had in that.
Well, it still resonates for you, I think, is that, am I understanding what you're saying? It still resonated for you, and that's a surprise.
Right. Well, I think you're right. Yeah.
After General Hospital, you went on to Days of Our Lives, if I've got my timeline correct.
You got it right,
We have a lot of fans who are Patch and Kayla fans, or we have a lot of listeners who are Patch and Kayla fans.
Yeah.
I am.
Your bio, you said that, I mean, you mentioned that you and the other head writers at that time created Patch. I'm assuming that was Steve Nichols, correct?
Yep.
I mean, it's not been recast. I just want to make sure on that because I'm not exactly sure.
Now, here, it's the same story as Tony Geary and General Hospital. We hired somebody to come in to be this bad guy, to be Bo's antithesis and friend and whatever. It was mainly that kind of story. We thought we'd put a let's put a patch over his eye and make him, you know, really, really kind of evil and mysterious. and it was that simple. He wasn't going to be there forever. It was no real long-term story. And we took one look at what he was doing on camera, and we said, we got to sign this guy to a contract. This is big stuff here. This is going to be great. And it became, you know, one of the great stories of Dave.
The camera loves him.
Yeah. Oh, and he's good too. I mean, he knows how to work it.
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely.
Yeah.
Now, forgive my ignorance on it, because I wasn't watching during that time, but was Kayla then, Mary Beth Evans, also on the show back then when you initially introduced him, or was she
on? I can't remember if she was on already and we brought Patch on, or if she came after he started. You know, my timeline, it's been a lot of years. And I don't remember, honestly. She was on already? Yeah,
yeah,
you know?
She was. Okay. Her and her sister, Patsy Pease, played her sister. And Patsy was doing the big scenes at that point, and the other character was just kind of in the background a little bit more until Patch got there.
Well,
that's right. In fact, I remember at one story meeting, sitting with Al Raven and saying, you know, Kayla might be somebody Patch might be right for.
So then in terms of the dynamic between Bo and Patch, you said you brought him in as the antithesis. What was it like watching those two actors together? For newer Days of Our Lives viewers, how was that dynamic created? Because obviously you see it now when they're much more mature, but when they're two young men, how did that dynamic play for you? Was it exactly what you wanted? Is it something that it was one of those things where it's like, oh yes, this is great with him, but then at the same time, we've also got the love interest for the sister. What more can you tell us about their dynamic?
I remember what I was trying to do was recreate the Tristan Tony,
dynamic
buddy. I really wanted to do the Scorpio Luke thing, and so it was an attempt at that in kind of a different way, with different characters, and you know we had our Australian accent with somebody else, British, Australian, you know, they always work. But I really was a fan of Bose. I thought he was terrific, and I think he's one of the great guys ever. And I really found the chemistry between the two guys rather riveting, and I think we really created a team there that people cared about. You really felt they grew to love each other, even though there was all the angst and hate and da da da, and the girls between the whatever they went through, and the storyline certainly. But you really felt that there was some genuine bonding. And you know, it's very interesting that women, the audience, the female audience, loves that kind of male bonding story. They were crazy about Tristan and Tony. There's something about it that touches them. Maybe I should ask you.
Yes.
Why does this work for women?
I was going to say that there's just something, seeing men bond like that, you know, kind of gives us hope that we might figure one of you out one day.
I got it. Okay. You know, I remember somebody telling me that their theory was, a girl told me years, and this hadn't popped into my head in many, many years, that her theory was that her husband, I remember she said, my husband has no real close guy friends. Oh, he plays baseball with the group, and he does this, and he does that, and he's got a buddy that they sometimes go to, I don't know, whatever they do, go drinking together or something, but she said he doesn't have anybody he talks to, and she said seeing these men able to open up to each other gives me hope that he'll have that one day, because she said she had it with a girlfriend. So maybe, you know, that was another theory.
Well, and you can't mention hope or Bo without mentioning Hope, and you were responsible for marrying them, and Bo and Hope.
I give good weddings.
Bo and Hope one of the iconic couples of Days of Our Lives history. What was it like to write that couple?
It was almost as good as Luke and Laura. I gotta say, it was absolutely wonderful. Days was a pleasure. All of Days, doing Days was one of the highlights. Luke and Laura's wedding in the Ice Princess story with Great and General Hospital, it got a little difficult after that. There were too many problems at the studio with on all levels there. Not only actors having a rough time with each other, but Jeannie leaving and everybody worried about the show, and it became an unpleasant place. And Days was just fun. I loved every minute of it.
What was your fondest memory in terms of writing their wedding? Because you say you throw great weddings. What was it about that wedding in particular that you remember most?
You know, I don't have a moment like Scotty Catches a Bouquet. you know, I just remember that we thought that worked so well. I am blank on the details. I don't know if there were any that made it that memorable, but I remember just, you know, being thrilled that we could pull this off. And I remember having tears in my eyes watching it. And whenever I can do that, I'm not a hard-hearted guy, but I write this crap, you know? And it's like, okay, this isn't, how is this going to affect me? It's not going to touch my heart. I made it up. But when certain scenes come around and they make you feel moved, you know, then I know it's good. And I remember that wedding moved me to tears.
In visiting with you just now, I was reminded of something that I'd often heard said before, but it was sort of another one of those urban legends. I've often read online amongst fans that the reason the DeMira family was started was because Days of Our Lives saw the success of the Cassadine family on General Hospital and what that happened. So is that true? Is it because if that was...
No, I don't know. I don't know when the Demira... Demira was around... I mean, Stefano existed when I got there. And I don't remember, certainly, when they began that or what the history was. My guess is that it wasn't a copy of the Demira family. First of all, I've never known a show to do that. I have never known a show to say, hey, on General Hospital, they're playing this kind of story, so let's get a character like that on ours. It just doesn't work that way. Yes, similar stories, similar characters show up just like this one, but it's almost like written in the theory of daytime that there is the bad guy. You know, there is the bad man, very powerful, very cunning, and you know, every show has one. And this was Days, but I remember we killed Stefano so dead that no one would ever resurrect.
I remember that.
Well, he's like Helena. They just keep coming back and back and back.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, if only real life could reflect that a little bit. Oh, man, there are a lot of people I wish I could bring back. But, yeah, it's just incredible that it's incredible to me that the fans, you know, put up with it.
Well, it's not easy. I have to tell you that it is not easy sometimes.
Yeah,
one of my fondest wishes is that they would stop bringing people back from the dead. You know, because it's just been done to death now. They can stop, you know.
Right.
It's not shocking anymore. Please stop, you know.
I think it's a cheap shot, and I think it reflects the fact that they don't have any story. They can't think of anything new. So, let's pull that, you know, that story out of the closet, and let's give that actor another chance. Now and then,
spicy.
I think maybe, like, Joe Mascola wanted to come back once, and they thought, well, you know, let's keep him happy and give him some more work, so they brought Stefano back from the dead. But I think that's a bad reason also. There's other work out there, you know, and there are other actors to be new bad guys.
Because you did such brilliant work at a critical time on General Hospital and then on Days also. You stepped in and you were there for some very forward-thinking, some ratings-grabbing storylines. And the soaps are all... They're on the crappy side right now, if you don't mind me just speaking plainly.
Yeah, that's all I hear. Yeah.
So if you were going to do this again, first of all, would you ever write for daytime again? Could they offer you enough? And second of all, what could you do now that would be fresh, that would bring some of this glory days back?
Well, I'll tell you, it's easy to answer that. In the first couple of years after I quit, I kept getting the calls from the agent and directly from a couple of producers saying, we want you back, blah, 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 blah. I'd put the garlic around my neck and hold up the crucifix and say, no, for all the money in the world, you will not get, I did my thing and I want to write books now and that's my life. However, I always tell the story that they hire you because you're a good writer and then never let you tell a story. And it's nothing but interference, and you are constantly trying to do what they're paying you to do. You're trying to simply tell your stories, and they're afraid of somebody being bad, and they won't like this, and the focus group tells them this and does that. Gloria was an amazing person in that she took the risks, and so few are willing to do it. And I don't mean taking risks by having people, be possessed and kind of outlandish, crazy story things. I just mean damn good story. And so, all right, what I'm getting to, however, is in the last 2 years, I have been called again and again and again by a producer in Canada. He knows me. He knows my work. The CBC up there knows my work. They have flown me up there a couple times. And they made me an offer this last fall in September for a show that I've created, and it is my own. And I've done it with this producer, and the CBC has bought it, and it is scheduled to go on the air in Canada starting next September.
Congratulations.
Now, with the writers, thank you. With the writers' strike, we're very fearful because I had to stop working the day It's funny. I was in Costa Rica, and I came back, on the day that the strike began, and that was the day that we were signing the contracts. That was the day that the money was changing hands. That was the day that my Bible was being turned into Toronto. But the good news is, I know they had presented the Writers Guild with an agreement, the same kind of thing that Letterman has done, so that an interim agreement, and it looks like it's going to fly. So this show may well end up on the air as planned next September. It's a half-hour soap, which is what I wanted to do, and it is about, it's different. It's about kids who are the sports stars of tomorrow. I know nothing about sports. I have no affinity for any kind of sports, but I got to tell you, I can steal from the New York Times sports page easily. It's about a group of kids in Vancouver, and they are hired by a company like Nike or Adidas who see their potential as the sports stars of tomorrow. They're the kids who are going to do the Olympics one day or be the top in the extreme sports and whatever it might be, from skateboarding to tennis to swimming to ice skating, all of it. And the story is really all about this company that hires them, and of course they get these kids to advertise their clothes, which they sell all over the world. There's an international angle because the CBC is getting money from an international thing behind this. It's called False Creek. It takes place in Vancouver, in an area of Vancouver called False Creek, and it's all about young passion and sweat and tears, competition. It's about having dreams and sometimes not being ready for them. There's a great story about a tennis player, not my story, a real story, or a tennis player. This kid got to number 6 in the world on the young, tennis strata. And then it was too much for him. And it's like that Heath Ledger story where at 28 years old, somebody just dies or dissolves or falls apart or whatever it may be. It was too much too soon. Stories like that. And I don't know, this is not groundbreaking. It's nothing so different, but it's something that I want to do. It's stories I want to tell.
It's a passion.
Yeah, I've got a passion for it. And there's an interesting aspect to working in Canada. In America, if you went in to pitch this story, you'd have to talk about the sex, the heat, how the demographics are going to work, da-da-da-da-da. In Canada, you convince them that you're going to show the ethnic and cultural diversity of Canada. There's a story between the Chinese-Canadian boy and the dirt poor girl who comes from Kenya. There's a story of a young tennis player who brings his parents to visit just before the big tennis match that they know he's going to win, and he's going to be their poster boy in all these third world countries and very Catholic countries, very Christian countries, South America, Africa, with a new line of clothing they're creating for him, and it turns out that his parents are two men. He's got two dads. And
nice twist.
Gay marriage has been around in Canada for a couple of years now, and several years, and they married immediately, and they've been together, and this boy loves his two dads, and the company is very worried about the backlash they're going to get in these countries. So it's got some juice to it. It's got some weight to it, and I'm getting kind of excited about it.
Well, it sounds like something that it would be fun to watch. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to get it down here, and we don't want...
I don't know. They're trying to make an American deal, and today, with so many new cable outlets and possibilities, it just might end up here, and if it's good, I would hope that it would come here.
We'll definitely stay tuned for that. I mean, because it sounds great. I actually lived in Canada for 2 years near Vancouver, so I'm very curious. Going back to Days of Our Lives for a moment, because the other thing that I mean, we have to mention this because of everything that's happened in recent weeks, at least within the daytime industry. But you helped create, or you brought on, the character of John Black. And He was recently killed off, and there's been lots of rumors about that. That's obviously, we're not going to ask you because you may not know, and if you would, you probably wouldn't say. But what was it?
Because you're all.
What
like
was
that.
It like? What was it like to create that character? To see him go to where he is now, the chemistry that he has with Marlena. What was it like to write John Black and to create him?
Well, it was terrific. It was one of my favorite stories. I really felt that it gave something real, a real meaty story to Marlena, who's had a lot of them over the years, but I thought it was a really good one. And it was all because of Roman leaving. I forget, what was his name, the original Roman?
Oh, who, it slips my mind.
Yeah.
It slips my mind at the moment, but we have another Roman.
Me too, yes.
Wayne Northrop. Wayne,
that's
Wayne
right.
Northrop. Wayne Northrop. Thank you. Wayne had decided to leave, and everybody loved him, and I did not. I never felt any kind of connection to that actor. And so I was a big proponent of the new John Black story and finding Marlena a new love and so on and so forth. And then, of course, Wayne came back later and whatnot. But I really liked it, and I liked the fact that he lasted all this time. And I was frankly shocked like a week or two ago when somebody said, "Guess what Days did?" You know, I went, "They killed off John." You know?
Well,
I don't know.
So did
I don't
we.
Know why.
That's what
well,
we
were
we, went,
we were shocked at it. But I mean, the thing is, it's like, and that was one of the reasons why I was very interested to hear your response to Belinda's question about coming back to soaps, because it's like nowadays you have Days of Our Lives, which NBC has made comments publicly that put its future in jeopardy in when it comes up for renewal in the end. So there's, of course, the possibility that Franz might pick it up over at ABC, but still there's no guarantee. And so for a character like him, there's some people that said, oh, getting firing John was budgetary, but then the fans reacted so badly, they brought him back. And so it's just one of those things where the whole John controversy has occupied a whole bunch of our time, at least on the Days of Our Lives front. And so that's why I was wondering, because it's like if one of these soap producers came to you and said, as a Hail Mary, I'm doing a last-ditch effort to save this show, I was interested to see what your response to them would be when Belinda asked you that question. Because there's a couple of them. Guiding Light, it's like 1.9, and it's been on for 70 years, and there's a possibility it may not be picked up this year. And it's like one of the concerns
they're all going to die. I mean, we do know that the end will come. It isn't going to be feasible at one point for them to spend the kind of money that it costs these shows to make these shows, and the viewership is dying. There are so many other choices. People's lives are changing. I think it'll be another 10 years, but I think you're going to see them dwindle down to half of what's there now.
Oh, most definitely.
In the next few years.
Most definitely.
You know, it's very interesting, though. Days, they used to tell us Days was going to be canceled when we were writing it. You know, it's something I pay no attention to, because it always was like, uh-oh, we're not so sure we're going to be renewed, and it always is. I would doubt the fact that Dave is going to go anywhere.
Well, and there's always the hope that Franz would be able to work out a deal to bring it over to ABC, because then that would give ABC a four-soap lineup against CBS. And then, of course, the advent of SoapNet and the fact that Franz has been trying to do spin-off shows of General Hospital and things there. Do you think that the soaps as we know them, if we are down to four, do you think that they'll still be on network television, or do you think they'll have made the jump to cable and then it will just become a niche market?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it probably will. I think that will happen. You know, I mean, the idea that there might be the soap network and they're all there for anybody that wants to go and see them is an interesting possibility.
Well, and if there is enough interest in the genre to support an entire network, you would think that there would be enough interest to keep at least one show on per network. You know, sometimes television doesn't make any sense from our side.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me, and I worked in it for 30 years. You know, I just don't get what they're thinking or what they do, and the kind of money that's wasted. You know, they're always crying about not having the money and you know, they're cutting the budgets. And yet, you know, if I were running the joint, I would find ways of saving money in a lot of places that they don't even look at.
I was reading on your bio that you mentioned that writing for you is nourishing to the soul, or for the soul. And so what advice would you give to people who are either aspiring to be daytime writers, A, or if they wanted to pursue becoming a novelist and writing their great American novel like you?
Well, I tell them the first thing to do is run for the hills. All of them.
Beat your head into a wall.
Right.
Yeah, beat your head until the idea goes away.
That's right. I always tell them, run, don't walk, go away, you don't want to do this. And then if they listen, they weren't meant to do it. And the people who don't listen to that, who say, this is my life, I am a storyteller, I've got to do this, those are the people who will do it. And you, the believing in yourself is something that is just something you have to have. I would tell people, you know, and I've told a lot, I get a lot of emails from young people who want to write daytime. There are a lot of us dinosaurs who are still working on the shows. So I'm not, but there are many others. You see those same old retreads, the same
exactly.
old names. Some of them are terrific. Some of them are wonderful. You need somebody with experience. You need somebody who knows the genre. But at the same time, you need fresh young blood. And I always try to drag that in. Whenever I was doing a show, I'd want to hire a new script writer who had never done it before. Gloria hired me, and I'd never watched a soap opera, you know? I mean, that's the kind of, again, risky thing that you need to do to jazz this up instead of having somebody who's been doing it for years and years and years. You know, it kind of becomes that old, you know, just we're going down the assembly line one more time.
Right.
I would make a difference on all the shows. I would, if I were the person in charge of the network, I would fire a lot of the writers with some big names, and I would bring in new people to give this a burst of possible enthusiasm that might grab the audiences, just like we did with the Luke and Laura thing. Because what else, what do they have to lose?
Oh, nothing at this point.
And if they could
stop meddling so much, it sounds like it's impossible. I write a column about the ABC soaps, and I cry all the time about the lack of originality and them not staying a course, not writing a story that has a beginning and a middle and an end.
Yeah,
where
right,
is the satisfaction?
Right.
Where's my payoff? And and it seems like to me from talking to you that a lot of that can kind of be blamed on all the different people that they're trying to please with what they do.
A lot of it. They're all so afraid. Right. Yes, they're afraid. They're running scared. I mean, look, I mean, the illustration I always give is, you know, Brad Pitt was my roommate. Well, I shouldn't tell the story that way. I should tell it with, we hired this kid. I brought this kid onto another world. We taped him for one day, and we looked at his tape, and I wanted to make him a soap star. I wanted to give him a 2-year contract because I thought he was really damn good. And they sat there, ABC, Procter & Gamble, the network people, the producers, the show, everybody. They hated him. He stunk. He couldn't act. He had bad skin. He was never going to be, tell him to be a plumber, I remember.
Oh,
was
my
one
goodness.
Of the lines that he told me. And, of course, his name is Brad Pitt. Had they liked him, he would have been a soap star forever, and he would have never done Thelma and Louise, and the world would be a different place for him. But
he would have been our beloved Tony Geary instead of the world's beloved
Brad Pitt.
Well,
he might be. So it worked for him, but... You know, the idea that these people, these morons, sit around these tables and pass their judgment on not only actors but storylines without being really creative people. A lot of them have come from, you know, from a business background. Procter & Gamble, number one. Number two, working your way up a network. These are jobs that nobody wants. They just want to be in television, and they finally get to that kind of glory place. But not all of them have the talent, the creative talent to back it up, which
I have accused them of that, oddly enough.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right on the money. And what they should do is they should trust the people they hire. You trust an actor to take those words and turn them into a moving scene. Trust the writers to give you the story and turn it into the kind of story that's going to grab your viewers instead of trying to make everything. It's gray. It's pablum. It becomes gray.
It is.
You don't know the stories we wanted to do that were so exciting and had real peaks and valleys, and yet it all became kind of mushy, you know?
Sort of bringing this all around, you started with a writer's strike. We're now in the midst of another writer's strike.
Right. Oh, I know. Yes, isn't it funny?
There's
You
mentioned a little bit ago that you read the New York Times, or you could get the sports stories from the New York Times. I believe it was in the New York Times recently that they did an article where they were talking about how the soap industry is taking and being affected by the writer's strike. And they were talking about how many of the writers are on strike, but at the same time, you have the new head writers over at All My Children's, which is James Harmon Brown,
and
Barbara Essenstein, who've taken Financial Corps. And there's also rumors of other people taking Financial Corps. Megan McTavish came out against them. Of course, she is the previous writer before them, so to be fair, she may have some bad feelings against them. But what's your take from a writer's perspective on the industry, whether or not these writers should be taking Financial Corps? How does that play into now versus then? What are your thoughts on that whole issue?
It's a tough one, because on one hand, you want to be in solidarity with your industry. On the other hand, daytime does not benefit very much from what the writers are fighting for. In any strike, we have benefited very little. We don't sell DVDs, so that isn't an issue for us. The internet, yes, that will be. That is, we don't know what it's going to bring, but there may be some revenue that comes one day, so I think that is an issue. But I gotta be honest with you, and I've thought about this a lot and talked to other people about it recently. If I were doing a show today, if I were, you know, a head writer on one of the shows, I really believe that I would do the Financial Corps thing to keep going. I say that because Financial Corps doesn't seem to be, unless it's going to hurt you in the long run, or that somehow you will be penalized for having done this, and we'll see what happens to people who took it in the future. But it seems to me that it's a very safe bet, because all that you suffer is that you can't run for office for the Writers Guild, which is something I never want to do, and you can't vote for those people who do run for office, so who cares? I think it's a way to keep working and keep your show going, and I kind of applaud the writers who have been strong enough to do it.
And how does, like, having gone through one of these, how does it work for, say, the executives? Because there's a lot, of course, with online rumors and the advent of the internet, which you didn't have to deal with back then.
Now
it's like, in the last several weeks, ever since people started taking Financial Corps, ever since the scab writer's script started going into effect, all of a sudden there's these huge cast upheavals on, like, at least two or three of the soaps. I mean, As the World Turns is cutting people right and left. Days of Our Lives is firing people who you would never, ever expect to be fired. Is this a period of time where, just because the fact that they don't have head writers, the executives can just pretty much come in and hire and fire? I mean, obviously they can hire and fire whoever they want, whenever they want, but is it one of those things where they feel they have more carte blanche to do it?
I don't know. I'm not in the trenches. I'm not there. I don't have a clue. I can only speculate, like you're doing and like everybody's doing. I would guess that this may be an opportunity for them to save money the way they had wanted to. And so it is a little bit carte blanche where they're able to just dump some people who were costly. That's often a reason that a character leaves, that an actor is booted, because they just can't afford he or she anymore. But I don't know the answer to what you're saying. I'm just thinking back to the strike in, what was it, 86, 87? 88,
I think it was, wasn't it?
88, okay, yeah. Yeah, and I, you know, we picketed and we marched and we did the whole number, and you know, we didn't work for the whatever it was, 6 months or 5 months or whatever. And when we went back to work at Another World, Sherry Anderson and I were fired immediately. And they hired the girl who everybody said wrote during the strike. It was, and they said no one could prove that she did, so she was home free and has had quite a career. And it was a very, very, yeah, it was a very, very tough time for us because, yes, we went on to other jobs, but at the same time, we were backing the Guild and we were doing the right thing. We refused to scab, and nobody even mentioned Financial Core then. I don't know if it was even possible, but it was something that no one told us about because I think we would have done it. We wanted to work. And, you know, you've got people who are, I'm single. You've got people who are married, got kids. They got, you know, they've got mortgages and they've got schools to pay for. And it becomes a very, very tough thing when it goes on as long as this has, and certainly as long as that strike went on. So, you know, I think back and I think that there's a lot of injustices involved with this whole thing. But to really answer your question about what's happening on the inside, I don't know. I'm curious. I'm surprised that they're dumping so many people. It's very curious to me. I don't remember them doing such a thing in the last.
Well, and another thing is it's almost as if from a standpoint of Brian Franz was recently quoted in an article as having said that because of the writer's strike and because there's so many actors out of business and the pilot season has in effect been canceled and that basically there will be no major new pilots coming out this next fall,
right.
That
right.
All of a sudden you right. have a lot of these former actors who would have, or daytime actors who have not, who may have been in the pilot season but did not necessarily have a steady gig, who all of a sudden now need to have their meat and potatoes paid for. And so it's like, I'm not saying that these people did this, but all of a sudden you have Rebecca Buttig return, you have Sarah Brown return, Debbie Morgan and Darnell Williams return, all these quote-unquote bigger names, depending on the era they're from, are starting to
yeah,
pop
right.
up. And so you have those people returning because they grab a headline. And then, but in order to pay for those people, you also have to take and get rid of a whole bunch of other people to be able to pay for them. So it's a very interesting
yeah.
dynamic to be in what we're going through now as an industry.
The deep pockets are gone. I illustrate that. In fact, I was doing a book club yesterday. I was speaking to about 50 women who were just delightful, and they were asking a lot about the soaps, and there were a lot of Luke and Laura fans, and I told them about one of my books called Never Forget, and I said, you'll love the history of this. When I first was hired at General Hospital, I had sold a second novel after The Great Los Angeles Blizzard. I sold it to Simon & Schuster, and it was coming out in hardcover in a year, and I hadn't written it yet. I'd only written an outline. And they had given me a $50,000 advance, and Jackie Smith knew about it, and she told me I'd have plenty of time to do that book. Well, 700 pages of Luke and Laura later, I called Jackie and say, Jackie, you got to get me some help, because I'm not going to be able to turn this book in. She said, oh, darling, sweetheart, like they talk, that's how they talk in daytime. You know, we're all one big family until they put the knife in your back. Darling, sweetheart, tell me how much they gave you. I said, well, they gave me $50,000. She said, oh, how wonderful. Well, let me think about it. 2 weeks later, I got a check in the mail for $50,000. It was from some development fund at ABC Television, and I said, what the hell is this? I called Jackie, and I said, Jackie, there's some mistake. My name got mixed up with somebody else's, and I got a check for $50,000. She said, oh, sweetie, that's to pay back your publisher, because you're right. You're not going to have a minute to write that book.
Oh,
so not only did they just hand me 50 grand for the fun of it, I never paid back the publisher because they never asked for the money. And back in those days, that's what they did. Publishers had deep pockets too, just like the networks. And they, you know, today they'd sue you in a minute if you didn't turn in the book on time. And I got a letter about 5 years later from Simon & Schuster lawyer saying that your editor has left and the editor-in-chief has left. And if you ever want to do this book again, please come to Simon & Schuster first. So So I ended up with $100,000 for that book, and then I did write the book in about 25 years later, and it was out like 4 or 5 years ago, and I got another chunk of money. So it was really a cash cow, but people had a lot of money then, and that is very different.
Before we called you, Belinda was actually telling me a story about your books. Belinda, would you be willing to share that?
No, why don't you?
Okay, well, she was telling me because we were discussing it. It's like, and because of course we want to do research and be prepared for it. And she's saying, I went down to my library. She says I've got every single one of his books on order, and she says I plan on reading them because she says I read 3 novels a week. I plan on having them done by the end of the next month or two. And she said it was just like that's so awesome. So what have you been doing since then? Obviously, you have the TV deal that's going to be coming here very shortly. You have the book.
I've got From Your Lips to God's Ears. I got the TV deal. I've done a book a year for 7 years, and I have a new book, but I'm not finished with it yet because it took a year to work on the Canadian project. So I'm behind on the new book. I've worked on a memoir, which is something I need to do because I need to tell these daytime stories and many, many other stories, not only Brad Pitt and Elizabeth Taylor, but my life and da-da-da-da-da. I've also got a project that we have real high hopes for. Cross your fingers for this one. My partner, Susie Horgan, who's like my sister, she was executive producer on One Life for a couple of years, and she won an Emmy as one of the writers on One Life as well. And she and I didn't know each other back then. And I always said, if we had worked together then, we probably would have hated each other with all of the nonsense that went on. Thank God we met later. But we have a nighttime series that we pitch as it actually came from Angela Shapiro, who ran daytime. And I didn't know Angela back then either. I know her now, and a couple of years ago, she came to Susie and me. I met up with her at a luncheon in Beverly Hills, and she came to Susie and me, and she said, she was head of Fox Television Studios.
I was going to say, that name sounds so familiar. And where have I heard that before?
Angela Shapiro,
right.
She ran daytime. She ran ABC. In any case, she's young, and she's hip, and she wanted some young show. And we pitched her an idea that had been swimming around in the back of my mind for a long time, and we worked on it with her. And then she left Fox, and she gave us, she said, this is yours, go for it. And the agent has just placed it with a producer named Jay Benson, who is absolutely terrific. He did, remember the movie Traffic?
Yep.
He did the series Traffic, which didn't last long, but it was brilliantly done. And he's in love with this show because he's a political junkie. It's called Adams Morgan, which is, if you know Washington, D.C., it's the area, the funky area of D.C., right next to DuPont Circle, where I lived 5 years, which is where all the young kids live, and it's where the clubs are and great restaurants. It's very funky and it got a lot of texture to it. But it's about the kids in Congress. It's about the Monica Lewinsky's. It's about the Foley boy. It's about the aides. It's about the interns. It's about the kids who want a future that's meaningful. They're so attracted to politics, and kids today generally are not. And we are determined that this is the show that's going to make politics sexy. It's a 1 hour drama. It's really the West Wing downstairs. It's upstairs, downstairs at the West Wing.
Yeah.
It's the kids working in Congress who believe in, doing something about global warming and da da da, plus the affairs and the whatever. It's that Grey's Anatomy kind of setting with these kids thrown together in competition, and yet these relationships develop. We are crazy about it, and we want to.
That's brilliant, Tom. That is brilliant, because the passion in politics would be such a soup to throw these people into.
And there's so much intrigue as well. Yeah. There's so much intrigue that you can explore there automatically.
There is, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a political junkie. I live
it. Oh, love it too. I totally agree with you.
it's right up my alley, and it's something that we've got real high hopes for, because the pilot script we did, I got to tell you, I'm really proud.
So then, hypothetically speaking, then, would this be one of those things that, once the strike is over, that could, I mean, in terms of, you hear about how Fox and CBS and ABC have all canceled all their contracts with all these things.
Yep.
It's just a matter of waiting for the strike to end before trying to get it there.
Exactly. And you know what? It's going to be difficult at that time because, you know, what everybody's doing, you know, all the writers in Hollywood are doing, they're developing new shows.
Their
while
home
they're
writing,
strike.
Yeah.
Their home writing, exactly.
Their home writing,
but
yeah.
Jay has given us his notes on it. We have not yet redone the script with his notes, which are brilliant. But the minute the strike is over, we're going to redo it, and he and Susie and I are going to pitch it, and we are going to sell this. So that's something else I'm doing that I'm in love with.
Good luck. I certainly hope. What I love as I'm a daytime viewer. I always have been. I'm immersed in this. I love it. And it really is fun for me when daytime actors get these nighttime shows. So I hope if all goes well that maybe we'll see some of our daytime faces on your new show when it comes about. That would be wonderful.
Well, I got to say, daytime actors are damn good, and they get short shrift all the time. Just this last weekend, I live in Palm Springs, California, where you're talking to me right now, under the palm trees, although it's a little chilly out here.
I would love to know what your definition of chilly is, because I'm in Nebraska.
Sounds beautiful, yeah.
It's like -5 the high. So I would love to know what your chilly is.
I know it's cold back there. Yeah, our cold is like 42.
Yeah.
I lived in Southern California growing up, so I have
So anyway, on Sunday, there was a performance at a little theater downtown Palm Springs that my friend Fern, who I met and worked on a show in Canada, the soap in Canada with, we went to see together because I've been friends with Judith Chapman for years and years, and she plays Gloria.
Yes, she does, and I love her character on that show. Absolutely love her.
Isn't she wonderful?
Yep.
Oh,
she is.
Man.
Those eyes.
Yes, yes. Well, anyway, she directed a version of the Catonsville Nine, which I have never seen. Even being a political junkie, I've never seen the Daniel Berrigan play. But she did it with all YNR people. So the entire cast was from the current cast of YNR, a show I don't know very well. But they were wonderful. I was so impressed that these were daytime actors up on that stage, and they blew us away.
Well, that's always wonderful to hear because, as you mentioned, they do get shortchanged, and it's like, oh, you're just a daytime star. And it's like, you know, if you start looking – one of the things as someone like myself who is in the process of developing this website and everything, and you start looking through – I mean, one of the things with blogging is you take and you tag all these posts with different people's names. Well, the list that you start compiling of former people who were in soaps – that are now in primetime and movies and huge names, and it's like, you know, someone somewhere sent out a memo a long time ago that says daytime stars are bad and give them bad press because no one will ever hardly admit to being one, but almost everybody is one.
Yeah, true. That's right. You know, it's just silly. The whole thing is silly. That somehow an actor is not an actor, he's a daytime actor. that a writer is a daytime writer, as if that's some kind of bad thing. Writers are writers. They tell stories. Actors interpret those characters and stories. I don't know what the difference is, you know, between daytime and nighttime when you actually get into a scene. It just amazes me that you get pegged that way. And it's been very
certainly
tough.
Doesn't seem fair.
No, it isn't. It isn't. It's ridiculous. But Hollywood does that. You know, Hollywood pegs people. I mean, you've often heard of, you know, the actress who did the beach movies and then could never, you know, do anything better because they pegged her as that, or somebody did a horror film once and that's all they ever got. And it still is to an extent like that because the person will do a certain role and they make a name for it. And then you hear that the next 20 scripts they were offered were that same part, basically.
It's
That's what makes some of their choices so interesting, especially with someone like Nicolas Cage or Brad Pitt, because they just refuse to be pigeonholed.
That's right. Yep. Heath Ledger was that way, too.
Oh, man, is that not sad or
that's
what?
That's true. So talented.
Yeah, that's just so awful. It's just so awful.
I don't know what to say. It's like, it's just...
Ever so many years, we have a young talent like that who winks out.
Yeah.
I remember the first one I remember was Pete Duell. He was starring in Alias, Smith & Jones.
Okay,
and a young actor. And I remember I was about 10 years old, and I think I was affected for life by this actor's death.
Wow.
Well, it has been an absolute pleasure visiting with you.
Now, wait, I have a question for each of you. Where does your passion for this come from?
Where does my...
Why?
Okay, Belinda, you go first. You go first.
Okay. All right. I have a pretty good idea about that. This is something that I started watching soap operas. I was an invalid as a child, and so I watched a lot of television, and I read a lot of books. And my favorite part of the days would be before my mom went to work for her evening job as a nurse, we would watch General Hospital together. And so it became something that is identified with family and bonding. And we would always drink cups of coffee and have like an after school snack. And it was conviviality and family and something like GH became some kind of a family, part of my family tapestry. And my passion for reading turned into a passion for writing. And then I just kind of fell into writing about the soaps, and it's been a wonderful experience. It just keeps me going constantly. I think the passion comes from my mother and from just being in love with television. I love TV.
And for me, it's one of those things where when I was a kid, my family was farming background, and every noon we would come in. And this was when I was really young, like 6 or 7. And my grandmother and mother would always have on Days of Our Lives on the television. And so it was sort of like you eat lunch and watch Days of Our Lives while you're eating lunch. And so it became a tradition like that. Well, then years later, my parents decided to not have TV. And so for years and years and years, we didn't have TV. Well, then during that time, I took up, I did a lot of reading, and I enjoyed reading a lot. Went away to school, which is why when I was in Canada, and even though I hadn't watched some of the shows in years, I caught up on Days of Our Lives and Another World, because Another World is probably one of my all-time favorite soaps. I absolutely love that soap.
Right.
When that soap was canceled, I was devastated.
You know, me too. I really enjoyed doing it, but I also enjoyed the show. I really thought that was a loss.
The Coreys and Jensen Buchanan and Tom Eplin and all those, it's just terrible. And so I had followed.
Oh God! You just reminded me of stories about Tom and the fun we had in New York those couple of years.
You're going to have to tell us those because
thank you for the trip.
You're going to have to tell us those before we hang up. But basically, while I was in high school, it was one of those things where when you're in a high school setting, living away from home, it's not one of those things where you really have time to watch television. And so I basically just read daily recaps. So once I got out of that and got on my own in college, it was like I started getting back into soaps once I was in college during basically my lunch breaks again. It was one of those things where it's like I picked up Another World, and then when Another World was canceled, I sort of followed those stars to As the World Turns, and then I had also started watching the General Hospital and All My Children at that time. I didn't start watching One Life to Live until later. But basically, it all started, like Belinda said, with your family. And that's one of the things that drives me personally nuts about this industry is it's like everybody's so focused on the 18 to 49 demographic. If they were just focusing on the 30 to 40 demographic and getting all those people rehooked, their children would be hooked for another generation. And so... For me, that's part of it. I enjoy it. That's one of the that's the reason we do the podcast and do the blog. But care to share your story about Another World?
No, let's just say there was a lot of booze
involved. Okay.
Oh, it's a story I couldn't tell.
Oh, okay.
Maybe in my memoirs, but it just popped into my brain, and it was just crazy, but we had a wonderful time. There were a lot of really, I think with Another World, we formed kind of a real, that family outside of the studio and whatever, and there were some great times that we had, and it's a time that I remember with real fondness that's very different from the other shows.
Well,
so
it has been a wonderful, wonderful time visiting with you.
Yes, you are welcome to visit
the podcast anytime you would like.
Okay.
Oh, definitely.
You got it.
Definitely. I'll come
back. I loved it, too.
Can I sneak one last question in?
Yeah, but I'm going to tell you, I want to send you each some books. So send me physical addresses.
Okay.
And this way you don't have to wait for the library, Belinda.
Oh,
okay?
They can be a little slow. Thank you. That would be great. I would really love to read your original Los Angeles Blizzard story.
Well,
is it still in print?
It isn't. It's been out of print for many years. But Deep Freeze is one I will send you because it's the same.
Okay.
It is the same story. Only I got rid of Ford Pintos and changed it to SUVs.
Okay. All right.
Right.
My son is shopping a book, and he was so thrilled that I was going to interview someone as successful as you. And he said, one question, Mom, you have to ask him. He's a 30-year-old man that writes horror, and he says, agent or not?
Agent.
He just doesn't know whether he – okay.
Agent. It's got to be an agent. There is almost no hope without an agent. Agents have taken the place of editors in the business. Editors no longer edit. They buy and sell, and they go to lunch. I have seen this. I've been in the trenches in publishing for many, many years, and I know many editors, and I know the world. Agents are the new editors in that you rewrite for agents today. Agents are the people who nurture a book with an author, and everybody wants the finished product today. That doesn't mean that you can't sell a book on a couple chapters in an outline. But it means that it's got to be so formed, it's got to be so beginning, middle, and end, it's got to be so ready that it's a finished product. And before, it used to be two lines, and they liked you, and then they worked with you for years on however long it took. That world is gone. And find an agent who's young and hungry and wants what you want. That's the best advice I can give. And with the internet, with the internet, you get every name of every agent in New York City. You can find out what they're looking for, what they specialize in. That is the way to do it.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
My final question then would be, looking back over your time in daytime, I don't want to end it on a negative note, so start out with the more negative one, but what would you consider your biggest triumph and biggest mistake in your career in daytime? What would you say those are?
The biggest triumph was Luke and Laura's wedding. Nothing comes close. it'll go with me to my grave. I got to tell you, the most meaningful thing that happened to me in daytime was doing the juvenile diabetes story on Days of Our Lives with Gloria Loring, and because her son was diabetic and da 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 da, and we were good friends, and we did that 2-year story, and I was given the Media Achievement Award that year by the Juvenile Diabetes Foundation, and Hope Lang and Mary Tyler Moore handed it to me, and it was one of the most honored moments of my life. I felt that I had done something more than entertain people, and it had great meaning. And I'm also diabetic, so that's got even more meaning. And it was at a time when I was just starting to take insulin, and I was going through that, and Gloria was helping. So that was a very, very meaningful year in my life. And biggest disappointment, I would say trusting people. I'm a good Midwestern boy, and I was taught that you trust people and honor them. And the world of Hollywood is not based on those principles. And it I suffered a bit at times. You know, it's all water under the bridge today. And I, you know, I'll probably have it happen again. I mean, it's the world of competitive, you know, entertainment business. But I think that was the one thing I wish I had looked over my shoulder a little bit more. It might not have been so painful. It was physically, emotionally painful to me that somebody I trusted would go out and try to boot me out of the job or try to, you know, get something I did. Things like that. And it's not just sour grapes. It's about people not believing in themselves strongly enough. Other writers I met were so terrified. They felt so insecure. And I always wondered, why don't they simply believe they're good, they're talented, they're great? Why do they have to step on other people? And not only me, I saw them do it to other people, other writers, and I never quite understood that, and producers and everybody. So I think that I wish I hadn't been so trustworthy.
Well, this has been an absolute pleasure visiting with you. We thank you so much for being a guest on the Daytime Confidential podcast. It has been an enlightening experience. It is so wonderful to be able to talk with someone who's had all the experiences that you've had and just be able to reflect and see where it is and where it was and where we're headed. And it's just been an honor and a pleasure to visit with you. And we thank you so much.
Cool. Great.